in his poem, "If God Should Go on Strike," Walt Huntley thanks the Lord that God has never stopped being God and shut off the sun or the moon or, thankfully, the oxygen. He concludes, "Men say they want a better deal, and so on strike they go. But what a deal we've given God, to whom all things we owe. We don't care whom we hurt to gain the things we like. But what a mess we'd all be in if God should go on strike." It's the same sort of lovely sentiment as "God never sleeps," or "God never stops working for us," or "God is good all the time." All that's true. But I think there was at least one time when God did go on strike. Today. The crucifixion is God on strike. And we who mark and worship on this Good Friday must understand this strike and heed this worker's call to change. There's a kind of strike called a work-to-rule strike. You see, workers can be punished in various ways for refusing to work or for slowing down their work in protest. So in a work-to-rule strike, workers do only and exactly what they're told. After all, how can you punish someone for doing their job? Taxi drivers, for instance, follow the absolute letter of the law, and the result is traffic for miles. Customs agents exhaustively search every car that passes through a checkpoint, and the result is traffic for miles. Factory workers operate machinery exactly as the original engineers indicated in the given handbooks. They set aside all the improvised systems that actually make the line move, and the result is, you guessed it, backups for miles. And this kind of strike works. The resulting drop in productivity forces change by demonstrating the danger, or at least the absurdity, of the prevailing rules. You can try it yourself. Only answer emails from your supervisors during the usual working hours. Do only and exactly what your significant other says when it comes to the dishwasher. Ignore your children's dinner requests until they submit the proper forms at window number 4. Suddenly, Jesus the Messiah's silence, meekness, even cooperation isn't so strange. He's working to rule. The prophet Isaiah describes the suffering servant. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, he did not open his mouth. And sure enough, we are told that when questioned by Pontius Pilate, Jesus gave him no answer. Faced with imminent death, Jesus offers no defense. He could have forced his tormentors to drag him to Golgotha. Instead, he carries the cross. There's no reason for him to participate in his own humiliation, but we're told Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Jesus doesn't try to escape, and this is a man who lived 18 years off the grid. He could do it. And he doesn't play on his divinity and annihilate the whole lot of the divine fire. Instead, the innocent Jesus stays and submits exactly to the judgment of those around him. It's a work-to-rule strike. God went on strike today. But what is this work-to-rule aimed at? Sin? Maybe. But Jesus had already been teaching people about how to live a better, more virtuous kingdom life. Death or violence or something of that sort, perhaps, but Jesus has already performed numerous healings and resurrected Lazarus. There doesn't seem to be much in Jesus' death that isn't covered in the signs and wonders of his ministry life. I think perhaps Jesus' last earthly act is aimed at our avoidance of responsibility. Jesus knows that we are already looking for a way to avoid the implications of his teachings for our own lives. And he knows that after he's gone, we will continue to find ways to ignore his call. We will ignore responsibility. Sin is something other people do. Jesus came for others. Jesus' reply No, sin is something you do. I come for you. Consider that the agents in the gospel story don't seem to be trying to avoid sin,
so much as attempting to avoid the
eventual fallout for it, the responsibility. First century Judea has become something like the world's worst office.
Everyone barreling toward a
disastrous product launch, but working at the same time to be the one who isn't stuck with the blame. Success has many fathers, it is said, but failure is an orphan. Everyone wants Jesus dead. No one wants to be the one who crucified him. Think about how we, too, avoid responsibility for the awful. We order someone else to do the dirty work. In the very first sentence of our passage, Pilate orders Jesus flogged. There's no blood on Pilate's hands. They're clean. Washed for at least 20 seconds. We hide behind these orders, behind legalisms and appeals to power. The soldiers are just following orders. Authorities are already distancing themselves from the death sentence they themselves can't issue, even as they push for it, goading Pilate with appeals to the emperor. And all this is simply to tell the bound man before us that he is mistaken about his condition. It is, in fact, our hands that are tied. This can't be avoided, we say. We distribute responsibilities and avoid critical decisions. By increasing the number of decision makers involved, responsibility is diluted, and no one person can be held accountable. And so Pilate appeals to the crowd, "Should I crucify your king?" Better still, if no one makes the decision, no one can be blamed. Let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to see who will get it. Randomness and algorithms alternately decide and help us avoid responsibility. When we do something bad, we do it quickly and get it out of sight as soon as possible. Since it was the day of preparation, the Jews did not want the bodies left on the cross during the Sabbath. They asked Pilate to have the legs of the crucified men broken and the bodies removed. Finally, we hide in words. We use the passive voice. They handed him over to them to be crucified. Crucified by whom? We are vague. They crucified him. Who's they? Jesus' crucifixion is a work to rule strike against this avoidance. God today refuses to play God for us. Instead, he takes on humanity and lives by our human rules. In doing so, Jesus proves himself Lord. He demonstrates the faithfulness of our God, a God who would submit to the life lived by those he loves. He demonstrates the cruelty, absurdity, and moral bankruptcy of the political, economic, social, religious, cultural systems under which we labor. Remember, all this was done in broad daylight. Likely an early April day like today. What was done legally, in accordance with that political, social, cultural, and religious system. And the result was the death of an innocent. Such is the end of all purely human endeavor. By fatally submitting to every last human order given, Jesus implicates us all in that death, in that sin. God did nothing that afternoon, but what we ourselves ordered. The result was our doing. We can blame other people or groups or for worldly ills. We can blame spirits and devils. We can blame structures and systems. But we are always already radically responsible. Each of us. All of us. Right now, all the time. We see in Pilate, the religious authorities, and the crowd what avoidance looks like. But what might this radical responsibility look or sound like? In our collect, we ask today for God to behold this, your family. We must pray that we do the same. Behold this, your family. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing beside her, he said to his mother, "Woman, here is your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Here is your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own home. Jesus, from the cross, beholds and recreates our broken human family, renewing radical mutual obligation amid fatal indifference and apathy. The murderous Cain refused to acknowledge that he was his brother Abel's keeper, and we too deny our obligations and avoid our human family. They can't be our responsibility, we say. It's too much to ask of us to care for others, we insist. We have our own selves and our own families to care for. "No," says Jesus, "here too is your child. Here too is your parent. We remain family, mutually and forever responsible for one another. And with God's help, we can bear that awesome responsibility." It's not enough for us to imagine that she is someone's daughter, Jesus says. She is our daughter. It is not enough for us to drive as if our kids lived in the neighborhood, Jesus says. Those are our kids. It's not enough for us to see if we can get our friends to call their elderly parents, Jesus says. They're our parents, too. It's not enough for us to wonder what we would say if it were our parent on the ventilator, Jesus says. That man is our father. It's not enough for us to say that it's a natural disaster for which no one can be blamed, not when we avoid confronting the human disasters, the poverty, the inequality, the injustice that compounds the natural disaster. It is not enough to insist that we are all in this together. We must work to make that a fact. In his crucifixion, Jesus comes for our excuses, for our empty apologies, for our self-deceptions when it comes to what we truly owe one another. He strikes against our half-measures, our violence, and our faithlessness. He invites, he commands instead, the radical, mutual, inalienable responsibility of family. Huntley's poem wonders what would happen if God went on strike. Our gospel reminds us that we know all too well what it looks like when we go on strike, when we refuse to work with and for our family. This is the crucifixion. Jesus went on selfless strike to end our selfish strike. And so we might conclude with something a little different today. People demand a better deal, and they manipulate the law. And so God, though still heavenly, became the man we saw. Jesus showed us all the horror of doing just what we like. What will come now of the dreadful day? The Messiah went on strike.